3:29 on WWLAMFM.com and the Odyssey app. Reading now from The Guardian, which, if you don't know, is a British newspaper. Article says, it begins each day at nightfall. As the light disappears, billions of zooplankton, crustaceans, and other marine organisms rise to the ocean surface to feed on microscopic algae and then return to the depths at sunrise. And the waste from this frenzy, which is Earth's largest migration of creatures, sinks to the ocean floor. It removes millions of tons of carbon from the atmosphere each year. This activity is one of thousands of natural processes that regulate the Earth's climate. Together, the planet's oceans, forests, soils, and other natural carbon sinks absorb about half of all human emissions. But as the Earth heats up, scientists are increasingly concerned that those crucial processes are breaking down. In 2023, the hottest year ever recorded, preliminary findings by an international team of researchers show that the amount of carbon absorbed by land has temporarily collapsed, and that the final result was that forest, plants, and soil, as a net category, absorbed almost no carbon. The director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research says it this way. We are seeing cracks in the resilience of the Earth's systems. We are seeing massive cracks on land. Terrestrial ecosystems are losing their carbon store and carbon uptake capacity, but the oceans are also showing signs of instability. Nature has so far balanced our abuse, but this is coming to an end. To help us understand this, we welcome climatologist Barry Keim to the show. Barry, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, Barry's a little informal. Do you prefer doctor or is Barry okay?
Oh, Barry's great.
Word. Okay. It seems, and as a layperson, it seems to me it's not quite correct to say that nature absorbed no carbon. It's just that it's not absorbing more than we're emitting, right? Like, this is about gross versus net. Like, if you're pouring water into a pool, and at the same time, you're pumping water out of the pool, and then suddenly your pump becomes less efficient, and the amount of water that you're pumping out matches what you're putting in, then you could say we've not pumped any water out of this pool, even though you have, because the net amount of water in the pool is the same. Is that a good metaphor? Is there something about this I'm missing?
That was beautiful. It couldn't have been said any better. I mean, carbon is a flux. You know, there's incoming sources, there's outgoing sources, and, you know, depending on how much you have incoming versus how much you have outgoing, that's what you have left. And that's exactly the way you stated that with the pool. It was a great metaphor and entirely appropriate in this particular situation. So I would argue some of the wording in that article is a little bit misleading, mm-hmm. but it does make an important point that, you know, there are thousands of processes, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe even more than that, that are taking place within, you know, naturally within our environment, that have some impact on what our atmospheric chemistry actually looks like and how warm our planet is. And what they're basically pointing out, though, is that this is unstable, and perhaps a little bit unpredictable. And as a result, it's leaving us a little bit hamstrung as we move forward.
Okay, great. People always say, you don't have to take the expert's word for it. Go and do your own research, which always freaks me out a little bit, because I think people don't understand what that means and what you're asking of yourself when you go do your own research. So I saw this article and I said, well, I wonder what other scientists think about that. I found a piece from Conservation International that said basically the same thing you did. You know, the thrust of the article is on point, but there's a couple things that they might be kind of myopic about. So this article elicits a lot of sort of panic from scientists on social media. They say this could lead to widespread ecosystem collapse, you know, within a decade. Very soon. You got other scientists who are saying, hold your horses. There is a lot of increase in carbon sink in places where forests are growing and the growing season is getting longer and there's more rainfall, and that this is all really important for scientists to take note of. But it's not cause for more despair than anything else that's been happening with the climate lately. So what's your take? Is this as scary as it sounds, or are you of the mind that, no, this is kind of actually par for the course?
Well, it's cause for concern, but not panic. I mean, what happened was 2023 was a very bad year. And And I think what the concern is, you know, is this, you know, some indication of what the future holds? And I'm not sure that's the case. I mean, 2023 was a pretty special year. It was the warmest on record. We had an El Nino taking place. You know how crazy the weather was here. I mean, it was unprecedented summer here last year. And what happened, I mean, we had forest fires all over the place. We had those big fires up in Canada. So we had a lot of unusual things that went on last year. And in the end, the vegetation across the globe just didn't take in nearly as much carbon as it normally does. In fact, it only took up about 25% of what it normally does in a given year. And that is a pretty big deal. But, you know, is this an indication of what the future really holds? Or was that just a one-off, a flukish year? I mean, I want to believe it's just a fluke. It, you know, it may be a harbinger for what the future, has coming for us. But there's so many uncertainties. And as I said, there, you know, literally are thousands, maybe tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of processes, many of which we don't even fully understand, mm-hmm. that play a role in regulating Earth's climate. So, am I concerned? Yeah, I am a little concerned. Am I panicking? Absolutely not.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned, people, even scientists, the people who work really hard on this, and they've got all the degrees and they've got all the resources and they go to conferences and they do experiments. The way that carbon moves through our environment still isn't really well understood, which I guess would contribute to the fact that none of this has been factored in. Like in the Guardian article, you got this guy from the French Laboratory for Climate and Environmental Sciences. He says none of the models have this factored in. Well, Barry, why is that? Why don't the models account for the fact that these natural carbon sinks become less efficient as they are overwhelmed by drought or bark beetles or whatever the environmental stressors are? How come the models didn't plan for that?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the bark beetles, because it just shows you how complicated some of this stuff gets. You push a button over here and you make, you know, six things happen over there, and it has this cascading effect. So it does get pretty wild pretty quickly. I mean, I think the bottom line is we just don't understand this well enough to model it accurately. And like I said, I worked with this guy when I was on the faculty at the University of New Hampshire, and he was a brilliant mathematician, Stanford graduate, PhD, and he worked with cancer and did all these amazing things. Well, we pulled him into our climate group, and he says, "Oh my goodness, this climate stuff is the most complicated stuff I've ever had to work on." And like I said, he was working with down at the cellular level with the folks in biology doing cancer research. So that just gives you some idea of just how complicated this particular issue is. Now, I mean, there's little doubt we're changing the atmospheric chemistry. I mean, yeah, we're pumping out all this CO2 and other greenhouse gases. The CO2 level back in the 1850s, 1860s, was about 280 parts per million, and it's now up at 419 parts per million. So another way of thinking about it is we've added an additional 50% of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So we're 150% of normal, relative to pre-industrial levels. And we're performing this very bizarre global experiment where we don't really fully understand what all the outcomes are going to be, which, you know, in and of itself is a little scary. But, I'm not sure it's maybe not as much doom and gloom as some people are projecting. But, you know, some of the impacts are not good. And, you know, here in Louisiana, we could very well be the most vulnerable state in the nation to climate change, given the way our coast is situated right near sea level.
Okay. I hadn't actually really planned to ask you about this, but this is just where we're at. The AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional, is how do you say that?
I don't know too much about that, but are we talking about the ocean circulation here?
Yeah. The ocean current system that takes warm air up from the tropics, guns it through the Gulf of Mexico, and then goes up, you know, past New England,
Europe,
then it cools off and it sinks back down and it goes back to. This is basically why Europe has the sort of temperate climate that it does, that it has for the last 13,000 years, is because of this ocean current system that's circulating warm and cold water in the Atlantic Ocean. Some of the same pieces that are talking about these carbon sink issues are pointing to real problems with this ocean current and the sort of similar warning that its collapse is closer than we think. Is this within your field of study? What do you think about this?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is what you're referring to is called the thermohaline circulation, which is how all the ocean basins are all interconnected. You know, when we talk about the Gulf Stream and the North Atlantic Drift and all that kind of stuff, these are all intertwined oceanic currents. Some of these currents run along the surface. You know, when the water properties change, as you know, the salinity changes and the temperature changes, the water gets heavy and it sinks, and then it runs along the bottom of the ocean. And all these ocean basins are way more interconnected than we ever thought they were before. But yeah, if the circulation changes in any major substantive way, it can have a dramatic impact on what the global climate looks like. And
does that look like? Like, kind of, can you get specific for us? I mean, I would basically understand, like, okay, you know, Europe will go into an ice age. The sort of global north will have a lot colder climates than we're used to. There'll be impacts on wildlife, on agriculture. Spell out like what this means for regular people.
Okay, well, let's use Europe as an example. I think that's a great one. If that North Atlantic Drift and the Gulf Stream, as we like to refer to it, were to basically shut down. Okay, so think about London, UK. Okay, London, England. It's at a latitude. It's at about 52 degrees latitude, I believe. Which is way further north. I mean, New York City is only at about 40 degrees latitude. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's see, Seattle, Washington is at about, 46 degrees or something to that effect. So London is pretty far north. You're kind of like central Canada. But think about how mild the climate is in London. I mean, they hardly ever get any snow there just because it's too mild. I mean, it hardly ever gets below zero. It's a very maritime climate, but it also has that warm water being drug up there, and it really modifies the climate of not only the UK, but really all of Western Europe. It makes it way milder than it should be for the, you know, how far off the equator, how high the latitudes are. If we shut down that ocean current out there, it's going to turn that area into the deep freeze, and it's not going to have that mild climate any longer. And obviously, that would be a big deal to the whole world's economic system and, you know, how the world works. So I think that's a really easy, straightforward one. But we have all these currents in all the basins doing, you know, very similar kinds of things. And we have a cold water current off of our coast, on the west coast, rather. You know, from Seattle down to, to Los Angeles and San Diego. And if we shut that down, that's going to become a heck of a lot warmer than it currently is. So those currents play a very big role, and that is part of the climate system. And, you know, and just show you how intertwined these things are, as the climate is warming, we'll be melting the glaciers in, let's say, Greenland. We're dumping all this fresh water into the Atlantic Ocean, you know, right where that North Atlantic Drift passes. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we may shut down that current, and that's going to affect Europe and do all those things that we were just talking about. So the climate system, very, very, very complex. There's so many moving parts that it's hard to wrap your hands around all of them. And this is where some of the limitations are in these models. These models literally have billions of equations to try to simulate the atmosphere, the ocean atmosphere system, to try to help us help us predict weather and predict climate as well.
Barry, can I keep you just about another 10 minutes here?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, great. I got two quick things I want to ask you and hopefully end on sort of a happier note. My guest is climatologist Dr. Barry Keim. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting in for Scoot. He'll be back on Wednesday. I got just about 17 minutes left here before we hand it off to the news. And after that is the second guest with Bobby and Mike out in the Silver Slipper Casino. Don't forget, we got the Saints Coaches Show tonight. Dennis Allen is going to be on at 6:30. Everybody's going to be tuning in for this one. All the other sports media people in Louisiana listen to WWL on Monday nights so they can hear from Dennis Allen, and you should too. 3:49 here on WWL, wrapping up with climatologist Dr. Barry Keim. Barry and I have been discussing this article in the Guardian newspaper about how Earth's forests have you know, stopped absorbing CO2 last year. There's a net zero absorption of carbon dioxide emissions. Was that just last year? Well, we see that again this year, in the next 5 years. We don't really know. Time will tell. But if we do see that trend continue, it's pretty much curtains for us being able to stave off the sort of worst effects of climate change. But Doctor, just with the last couple minutes that we have here, I just wanted to ask you, despite these challenges that we have, you know, both with the sort of international climate agreements and getting these countries to agree to these targets and then actually do the work to hit them, despite the challenges that we may face with the natural systems, you know, the ocean and land-based carbon sinks, you know, sort of faltering, at least in the last year, are there reasons to be hopeful about our ability to use nature to fight climate change, or the worst effects of it anyway?
Well, yes, that's a great question. And I would say the answer is yes, there is hope. And the one thing I would point to is this is, you know, going back some decades now when we recognized that ozone was a problem. And when I say ozone, I'm not talking about ozone down in the troposphere, the lowest layers of the atmosphere. I'm talking about the ozone layer in the stratosphere that we were, you know, all concerned about. And we all collectively, when I say all we, meaning society in general, the whole globe, recognized that we had a serious international problem. They put together what's called the Montreal Protocol in 1989, and it was an international agreement to basically stop producing all these CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, you know, better known as Freon. It's also used as a microchip cleaner, you know, and so on and so forth. So we recognize it as a problem, and we dialed that back to the point to where we essentially quit destroying the ozone layer, at least in the, you know, in the dramatic way that we were doing it back in the 70s and 1980s. Mm-hmm. So that's the one thing I always point to, that when society fully realizes that we have a problem and our future rests on international agreements, we can actually pull something off. And that's my hope, is that if this just continues to spiral out of control, I'm not saying it's going to, but if it did, I would think that we could get everybody. I mean, that's an example. We can point to that as one thing that we've done where everybody recognized we had a problem. We all hunkered down and made a difference and basically phased that out. So that's where I see the biggest hope. Otherwise, I mean, we're completely, addicted to fossil fuels. I think we've made at least a half a step in the direction of you know, moving off of that and getting on to, you know, more electric, powered cars and things like that. Of course, that has its host of problems too. Mm-hmm. But you know, I've asked a few questions about that, and this was kind of interesting, in terms of, like, you know, obviously the energy, the electricity used to charge up your car ultimately probably has some fossil fuel behind it to generate the electricity. And I was just kind of wondering, well, what is the miles per gallon equivalent, right? And it's, you know, the average, I believe, was about 75 miles per gallon if you drive an electric car relative to a gas-powered car. So that's a pretty darn big improvement.
Wow.
So we are moving in that general direction. I mean, we're obviously not there yet. And like I said, all these batteries have other problems. We got to figure those out. But anyway, there's definitely hope. There's reason to be hopeful.
Well, we will speak to you again, and hopefully we'll have more good news to talk about, things that are moving in the right direction. My guest is Dr. Barry Keim, WWL's favorite climatologist. Nice to speak to you again, Barry. Have a great week.
Yeah, thank you very much. Good to be here.